Philip II of Macedonia. Philip II's campaigns of 357 and 356 BCE. Now, Philip had enjoyed another year of victories, but his success was beginning to worry his neighbors. By the end of 357 BCE, threats were growing on all sides. Some scholars have even suggested that this was the time when the dangerous wars threatened. And Justin claims that Philip was named king instead of regent by the assembly, assuming that the author was right about this in the first place. Illyrians, led by King Grabus, were preparing for war with Macedonia, as were the Paeonians, led by King Lysippus. To the east, Cetraporus, who controlled almost a third of the Thracian tribe, saw an opportunity to strike. These three kings formed an alliance. Although the object was less about direct cooperation than to present Philip with a number of threats simultaneously. He was already at war with Athens, and the Athenians began the search for allies. For the moment, they focused on the cities of the Chalcidian League, the same cities whose envoys had received an encouragement when they offered alliance not long ago. Together, the League cities fielded much stronger forces than Amphipolis, and both Philip and Athens saw them as a decisive factor in the coming struggle. Philip offered to grant the Chalcidians the city of Athamas, which was part of his kingdom, and also gave them Potidaea, which he had just first captured. Originally a Corinthian colony, Potidaea had at times been part of Athens' empire and had been retaken by the Athenians in 363 BCE. It stood on the isthmus of the western finger of the Chalcidy, with easy striking distance to Olynthus, the leading city of the league. Philip asked little in the way of direct aid from the Chalcidians, merely that both parties promised not to make a separate peace with Athens. As an offer, it was extremely generous, always supposing that, of course, he was sincere. Perhaps the rumors of the secret deal with Athens over Amphipolis fed suspicion. Or perhaps the Chalcidians were simply cautious, but they and Philip consulted the oracle of Apollo at Delphi, asking whether the treaty was wise. Although relatively common in the early periods, this is the only recorded occasion when this happened in the 4th century BCE, and we do not know which side insisted on the precaution. In the event, the oracle's answer was clearly satisfactory, for the treaty was signed and copies inscribed in stone and erected at Delphi, Dium in Macedonia, and Olynthus. This last copy partially survives, albeit mainly with clauses threatening divine punishment for anyone who broke the terms. In the spring of early summer 356 BCE, Philip marched to Potidaea and began the siege. Athens, having failed to ally with the Chalcidians, now turned to Philip's tribal enemies. But once again, she moved slowly, and no agreement was reached with the three kings until July. By then, the situation had changed so drastically as to render the alliance meaningless. Paeonians, or at least those following Lysippus, were defeated and their resistance collapsed. A Macedonian force commanded by a general named Parmenio beat Grabus' Illyrians in battle and ended that threat. This is the first time we hear of a man who had served Philip and Alexander as a senior and highly able subordinate. He was already most likely in his 40s and may have served under Philip's father or brothers, but little is known about his early career and origins. He may have come from Upper Macedonia or he may not, and it is hard to tell whether his family's rise to prominence was due to Philip's favor or whether they were already wealthy and important. At some point, Philip received an appeal for aid from the citizens of Crenides, who were exposed to Thracian raids by bands loyal to Centroporus. Founded as a colony by the island city of Thanos around 360 BCE, Crenides was set up to exploit the rich silver deposits and other minerals in the area. In the past, the Thracians had destroyed more than one Greek effort at securing these and similar resources, which explains the willingness of the Crenides to sacrifice its independence for the sake of survival. Philip hurried to its aid in person, presuming to take some of his forces while others remained to keep Potidaea under blockade at the very least. He drove off the Thracians, took control of the Crenides. He soon refounded and named it Philippi, the same place later famous for the defeat of Brutus and Cassius, and whose Christian community received one of Paul's letters. Combined with Amphipolis, Philip had hugely increased his income, giving himself a steady flow of precious metals. At some point in the next year or so, he besieged and took three smaller Greek colonies in the region to ensure that all was kept firmly under his control. Philip returned then to his siege of Potidaea. It had taken Athens 2 years to blockade the place into submission during the Peloponnesian War, while Olynthus and the Chalcidians had failed to capture it in spite of living so close and possessing a sizable army. Philip took the city in a matter of months, and it may have surrendered to avoid the final assault. True to his word, Pedaea and its lands were transferred to the Chalcidians. Philip gained some personal profit by selling the Pedaeans as slaves, but he was once again generous to the Athenians garrisoning the city, who were allowed to go home without having to pay a ransom. An Athenian expedition had arrived off the coast just after the city had fallen, and once again Athens had dithered and ended up taking no effective action. The instinct for historians is to speak of the Athenians missing another great opportunity, just as they had missed their last chance to take Amphipolis. This is to forget that Philip was just one of Athens' problems, and by this time, Athens was focused far more on defeating its rebellious allies and on internal bickering over where the blame lay for the failure of a recent campaign to the Gallipoli Peninsula that led to putting a number of their own generals on trial. There was also no good reason to expect the Macedonian resurgence to last and to doubt that there would be opportunists to reestablish their presence in the area. For the moment, their only toehold within Macedonia's heartland was the allied city of Methone. Philip had enjoyed another good year. Just after the fall of Pedaea, he is supposed to have received three messages on the same day. The first was a report of Parmenio's victory over the Illyrians, and the second, another victory, this time one of his horses at the Olympian Games. By this time, we do not hear of any question over whether or not the king of Macedon was eligible to compete. The third message informed him of the birth of Alexander. Given that he was born in July and the games were held at the end of the summer in August and September, the chances of the news arriving on the same day are slim in the extreme. But once again, it makes for a very good story. Macedonian settlers were introduced to the newly named Philippi, but neither the Greeks nor the Thracians already there were wholly supplanted. Workers began draining nearby marshes so it could be cultivated. And this surely is an indication of similar developments throughout the kingdom. Soon the mines near the city were providing Philip with 1,000 talents of silver every year. Combined with the yield from the workings at Mount Paganum, Philip was now very wealthy indeed, and this was marked by an increase in the quality and quantity of his coinage. Gold coins were produced into the Attic standard, while the silver conformed to Thracian weights, a balance that helped trade. Most of the goods that passed into Europe, whether through Thrace or Illyria, from now on also passed through Macedon. This gave more revenue from tolls as well as access to a wide range of commodities. One coin issue in 356 BCE depicts the racing horse and jockey that had triumphed at the Olympics. The Macedonian aristocracy had long a fondness for finely made vessels and ornaments, and this was reflected in their increasingly conspicuous lifestyle, most of all in the palace. His greatly increased income allowed Philip to hire mercenaries to supplement his army. In particular, he attracted growing numbers of specialists, such as engineers, and funded their research. At some point, pay was introduced for the Macedonian soldiers, and the higher ranks within the phalanx were marked not with disprestige and responsibility, but higher rates of pay. His new settlements allowed him to grant soldiers the right to share the produce from set areas of land. And this combined with their pay freed them to be virtually professional soldiers. Philip's men trained even when there was no war, drilling in formation, practicing with weapons, and marching long distances. Route marches of 37.5 miles on a day are mentioned by one writer. Philip banned the use of wheeled transport for ordinary baggage and reduced the number of servants, making the soldiers carry their own equipment and food. Cumbersome though the sarissa was, the rest of the pikemen's equipment was light in comparison to the hoplites' panoply. Less burdened and toughened by their training, Philip's army became highly mobile. Its sheer speed of movement was something that would surprise one enemy after another. So next time we'll look at his companions. Now the sources for this, The Politics by Aristotle, The Histories by Herodotus, Histories, 12 volumes, by Diodorus Siculus, Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, and The Lives by Plutarch. Philip and Alexander, Kings and Conquerors by Goldsworthy, History of Macedonia, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Hammond. In the Shadow of Olympus, The Emergence of Macedonia by Borgia. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.